minister of St. George's Tron Church in Glasgow, Scotland. As a preliminary, Tom Allen offered what he called a modern Scottish parable.
This story concerns a Scottish regiment, in fact, the Glasgow regiment called the Highland Light Infantry. And during the last war, a certain battalion of the HLI was moved from one base to another. And when they got to their new camp, they found, to the consternation of the padre, that there was no place where they could hold their Sunday services. There was no church. And so the padre went to the commanding officer, and the CO said, well, there's an old listen hut out there on the perimeter of the base. He said, it's in bad shape, but if you can do anything with it, you're welcome to it to use as a church. And so the padre took two of these Glasgow boys with him to see this broken down listen hut. And when they arrived at it, they found that the roof had fallen in, there were no windows, the floor was up, and so on. And the padre said to these two Highlanders, he said, do you think we could do something with this place, boys? And they said, sure, padre, you leave it to us. One of them was a house painter to trade. Well, 2 days later, the padre came back, and the place was absolutely transformed. They had put new windows in, they had roofed the place over, a new floor had been laid, and the place had been painted from top to bottom. It was absolutely marvelous, except for one thing. In an access of patriotic zeal, the house painter from Glasgow had painted on the wall over where the communion table was going to be, in tartan letters, a foot and a half high, the following motto: Scotland forever. Well, the padre looked at this. He looked round about at the marvellous transformation that had been made, and then he looked at Jock again. You see, he didn't want to offend him. And he said, Jock, you've done a great job. Wonderful job, he said. But, he said, do you think we might have something just a wee bit more religious up there? See? The boy looked at him and said, a wee bit more religious. And then his face brightened up. He said, padre, I see exactly what you mean. I don't know why I didn't think of it in the first place. Leave it to me. Well, padre went on. 24 hours later, he came back. Came in the door of the listen hut. The place had been given a fresh coat of paint. It was glistening and gleaming even more than it had been the previous day. And then he brought himself to turn his eyes to the wall. He had asked for something a wee bit more religious. The tartan letters were still there, a foot and a half high. But the motto now read, Scotland forever and ever. Amen. I have it, gentlemen, on the most reliable authority that that is a true story. Well, as I say, it's a kind of parable. You see, for this decent man from Glasgow, something a wee bit more religious meant simply the addition of a form of words. For this man, something more religious meant simply a kind of conventional use of language. And it seems to me, you see, gentlemen, that perhaps the most significant thing that is happening in the life of the church in the world today is the discovery that religion, whatever else it means more than conventional phraseology.
The Christian today, Tom Allen suggested, must be vigorously involved in three kinds of activity, namely perception, preparation, and penetration. In his first address, he spoke of perception. To begin with, he said, the Christian must have a mature understanding of the world in which he lives.
8 years ago, I went to minister, as the chairman said, in a downtown parish in the center of Glasgow. A church that had been in existence for 150 years. 75 years ago, it was one of the fashionable churches of Glasgow, with a membership drawn from the wealthy merchants who had been thrown up by the vast expansion of the Industrial Revolution. But for the past 75 years, with the explosion of population and with the movement of population from the center of the city out to the suburbs, 8 years ago I found a church which still retained the external appearances of a once great tradition. Set down in the center of a city the size of Toronto, with a tiny membership of devoted, dedicated people who loved their church, but completely divorced from the pressures of the world around its doors, from the prostitutes whose beat was in my very parish, from the ex-convicts and alcoholics and teddy boys who spent their time on the very doorstep of this church. We were there a very religious people. And yet this church had absolutely no vivid, vital, living, dynamic connection with the world around its own doors. And so often this is precisely what we religious people are like. And it seems to me that our mission as Christians begins with a fearless, mature, perceptive understanding of the world in which as Christians we live.
Apart from the world at his doorstep, the Christian, said Tom Allen, is inescapably involved in the world at large. The unthinkable advances in the scientific manipulation of power, the division of the world into two diametrically opposed ideologies, the rising tide of nationalism in underprivileged countries, to mention only some of the forces on the world stage, and perhaps the greatest challenge to the church, the secularism of modern men.
This, to me, is the most desperate of the signs of the times. In the modern world, man is left alone with man. And from his loneliness stems that despair so vividly illustrated in the dramatists and novelists and poets of our day, in Sartre and Camus, in Osborne and Wesker and Beckett, as well as in the brittle unhappiness and anxiety and frustration of ordinary men. The real issue today before us is that we're living in a generation which thinks of God, when it thinks of him at all, in non-personal and abstract terms. The fact that men today live out their lives, they don't call themselves atheists. I remember an old farmer on the Scottish borders whom I went once to speak to when we were involved in our mission of visitation in a rural district. And he listened and he said a sentence or two from time to time, and then I asked him about his own personal religion. Well, of course, he said, I believe that there's a something, and he pointed towards heaven. I believe that there's a something. Men are not atheists, but the God in whom modern man believes is not the personal God of the Bible. He's not the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He's not the God who breaks into history in his Son. Not the God who knows the deepest concerns of your heart and who loves you, as St. Augustine said, as if there were only one of you to love.
Tom Allen went on to suggest that today's Christian must strive for a mature understanding of his faith. He recalled the advice of St. Peter to the early Christians. Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason for the hope that is in you. And he also recalled a statement by a 20th century Christian, Dorothy L. Sayers.
Dorothy Sayers says this in one of her essays. She says, the average church member is about as well equipped to do battle on fundamentals with a Marxist atheist or a Wellesian agnostic as a boy with a pea shooter facing a fanfare of machine guns. And I don't think, gentlemen, that many of us would care to dispute the truth of that. I remember how this was brought home to me in a very real and simple and practical way. In my first parish, we had a visitation campaign. You know, a campaign of visitation evangelism, I think it's called, on the side of the Atlantic. And I'll never forget the awful consternation that appeared on the faces of these decent Scottish elders that night. And they came to me and said, "Mr. Allen, we'll do anything you like." They said, "We'll paint the church, we'll build a new church hall, we'll put in a new boiler, we'll run a club, we'll do anything, but don't ask us to go out there visiting the folk in the parish. We could never do that." Some of them pointed to an elder of mine called Jack Aiken, a very good chap, and they said, "You ask a fellow like Aiken, he's got plenty to say, he'll do it, but don't ask us. We couldn't do this kind of thing." Well, after a bit of Presbyterian browbeating and totalitarianism, I finally got these men out into the parish, you see, for this visitation campaign. And I'll never forget the night that they went out. I was left sitting in the church hall waiting for them to come back and report. I'd given them all notebooks and pencils to write down their findings on, you see. And off they went into the unknown. And I sat in the church hall, and if their hearts were filled with trembling when they went, it was nothing to the trembling that was going on in my heart as I saw them go. Well, about half an hour later, Aiken came in. And there the door opened at the back of the hall, this big, bluff, cheerful, hearty Scottish elder with a face about 6 feet long. And he came up to the table where I was sitting. He took his wee notebook that I had given him. He threw it down on the table in front of me and said, "Mr. Allen, I'm resigning." I said, "You're what?" He says, "I'm resigning." I says, "What's happened, Jack?" "Well," he said, "the first house I went to tonight, I knocked on the door," he said. "And it was a man that came to the door. And he said he didn't say what you said he would say." I had told these men, you see, that if it was a man that came to the door and they said they were from the church, they could bet on it that he would say, "Just a minute and I'll get my wife." That's what they usually say. And well, Jack Aiken said, "He didn't say that, this man. He said, when I said I was from the church," he said, "Is that right?" "Well," he says, "brother, I've been waiting to meet you for a long time. Come on in." So, said Jack Aiken, he took me in, and he sat me down in a chair, and he said, "Mr. Allen, I think you must have been one of these kind of communist characters, you see, because he seemed to know an awful lot of questions." And he says, "You're an elder of the church." And I said, "Yes, I've been an elder for 35 years. "Ah, well," said this man, "you're just the man I've been looking forward to speaking to." He said, "You'll be able to tell me how you can possibly believe that Jesus was both God and man at the same time." "Well," he said, "the fact of the matter is, I didn't have an answer to give that man. I, who have been an elder of the church for 35 years, had nothing to say." And he said, "If, as you claim, our duty is to be witnesses for Christ out there in the world, then you've got to train us for it. And we've got to be able to give an answer to those that ask us." However, I said to Jack Aiken, I said, "You know, it's most unlike you to not to have an answer, Jack," because he was the kind of man who, you know, was pretty articulated most other things. "Oh," he said, "I had some kind of an answer, Mr. Allen." I said, "What did you tell him?" "Well," he said, "I told the man to come to the church on Sunday and I'd get you to preach on this subject." which wasn't in itself a bad answer. But if the church, through its laity, is going to reach out into the world today, gentlemen, then the church must provide the equipment with which this is to be done. It doesn't mean that all of us are called upon to be systematic theologians. It doesn't mean that our witness to Christ necessarily involves us in preaching prepared sermons, but it does mean that we are expected to be able to give some account of the faith that we profess.
Finally, Tom Allen said, the perceptive Christian will strive for a mature understanding of the commitment which he owes.
First, we must realize that Christian commitment is not loyalty to an idea or a creed, however hallowed by tradition, or a church, however loved and honored. You remember when the risen Christ appeared to Peter and some others of his disciples, this was the searching question he asked three times of the man who had denied him. Simon, he said, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Three times. He was not concerned at that point with Peter's loyalty to an idea. He wasn't concerned with Peter's adherence to an institution. He wasn't even concerned with the quality of his ethical standards. He was concerned supremely with Peter's attitude to himself. Gentlemen, Christian commitment means that total abandonment of self to Jesus Christ, mind, heart, and will, which he demands. Secondly, Christian commitment involves, as an inseparable part of our self-giving to Christ, it involves an inescapable dedication to the service of his kingdom in the world. Lovest thou me? Christ said to Simon Peter. And then, swift upon Peter's answer, came the command, feed my sheep. Mission, evangelism, service, witness, outreach. These gentlemen are not alternatives upon which we may be engaged if we choose. These are imperatives about which we have no choice at all. The church which is not concerned with mission has forfeited all right to the name of Christ. And the Christian who is not seeking to reach out to the world has never come face to face with God. I read just before I came here a brilliant autobiography called Name and Address, written by T.S. Matthews, who was an editor of Time magazine until fairly recently. T.S. Matthews' father was a bishop of the Episcopal Church in the United States. He was brought up in a Christian home, but like so many intellectuals of his time, he gave up all profession of formal religion. And in the last chapter of his autobiography, he describes his search for faith and tells how he went one day in London, England, to a church and found outside the church this notice. It was open all day. This notice outside the front door: thieves infest this church. Beware. And T.S. Matthews says, if it were true that outcasts and sinners infest the church instead of avoiding it, I too might have learned to feel at home there.
In his second address to the Elgin House Keswick Conference, Tom Allen spoke of the Christian's need for preparation, preparation to play his part in Christ's mission to the world.
Please notice that I speak of Christ's mission to the world. I believe that the greatest lesson I ever learned in my study of evangelism was the lesson that Christ himself is the evangelist. It is not as if, gentlemen, you and I were being sent out on a mission by an absent king. On the contrary, we are being called to participate in his mission, in Christ's mission to the world, because he is already at work in the world. And to know this saves us both from pride and from despair. From pride, because anything that is ever accomplished is his doing. and from despair because we know that he can never be defeated.
In the work of mission, said Tom Allen, the Christian must prepare for at least three problem areas. First, to win a man for Christ, one must establish contact with him, and this responsibility cannot be left entirely to the minister.
I think we're beginning to realize in the churches, gentlemen, and I'm sure you are in the church in Canada, that the minister by himself cannot achieve this contact which is absolutely essential. In fact, you know, in Scotland, if I may have a little aside, do you know one of the best ways to get a railway compartment to yourself when you're traveling in Scotland? One of the best ways is to travel with a clerical collar on. And sometimes when I'm going on some longest journey in my own country, I put on a clerical collar if I want to do some reading, you see, and sit at the platform side at the window, just kind of looking out like that. And you'll see a man, perhaps a little late for the train, belting along the platform, you see, looking for a compartment. Then he'll come to yours, then he'll see the dog collar, and then he'll go. Now, very often I travel with a collar and tie because I like to speak to men and to meet them where they are. You know what happens? As soon as a man realizes that you're a minister, he ceases to be the man that he is and becomes the man that he thinks that you think he should be. This is true. And this is one of the reasons, apart from the simple physical impossibility of this, why the minister by himself is unable to achieve this essential condition of contact.
There are many who feel that mass evangelism meetings are an effective means of contact. They can be effective, said Tom Allen, but they cannot be the whole answer.
The very people whom we are most anxious to win for Christ and the church are the very people who are not present at these great meetings of mass evangelism. And I have to ask myself, I who do this kind of work myself, is the gospel only for those who will come to my meetings? Is the faith once delivered to the saints only for those who will accept my invitation to church? And the answer surely is no. And so we're left with the problem of contact.
There is also the problem of communication. How do you communicate to secular man?
How do we begin to communicate the gospel? He dropped the people off at the meeting. He found himself at a loose end because he had no money. His normal procedure was to go to the pub for a pint, but he didn't have the price of a pint that night, and so he had no alternative but to go into the service with the folk that he was driving in the bus. And so he did. And he listened to Graham's sermon from the Kelvin Hall. This tough, tough bus driver, this character who had no time for the church, had never thought seriously for two consecutive minutes in his life about religion. And when Graham made the appeal there in the cathedral in Bristol, this man found himself miraculously and mysteriously going forward to the front with the others who went and giving his life to Jesus Christ. A week later, I met that man. Just 1 week later, I met him in Glasgow. He came up to see, for the first time, the man through whose preaching he had been converted to Christ. And I met him in Glasgow when he came up, and I've never seen in my life a man so radiant with eternity. His face was shining. I said, "How are things going?" He said, "This is the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life." He said, "My life's been turned upside down. I'm a new man." And you could see that he was a new man. The inner light was burning out of that man's face. And I said, "How are things going as a Christian?" "Oh," he said, this is great," he said, "Mr. Allen." He says, "You know, I'm a bus driver." "Well," he says, "I've got to take these people in bus runs and so on." And he said, "It's marvelous. I can get witnessing for Christ all the time." He says, "I've got a captive audience." He says they can't get away. He says, I preach to them, I talk to them, I talk to the conductresses and the conductors and the garage and so on. Marvelous, he says. Wonderful. Now, a year later, I went to speak at a big conference in England. And there was that bus driver. And he was still, obviously, deeply committed to Christ. But it was amazing to see the development of that man in a year. And you could see this in the man's face. He had become a mature Christian. And I said to him, how are things going now? He said, Mr. Allen, in the past 12 months, I've learned one great lesson. He said, I've learned this lesson, that we've got to earn the right to speak. We've got to earn the right to speak. It seems to me that the British bus driver was saying in his own vivid way precisely what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good work and glorify your Father which is in heaven. What does this mean, gentlemen, in practical terms for the churches to which you and I belong? It means, I suggest, nothing new. Nor does it involve us in the problem of finding some magic formula or technique or presentation or organization by which the challenge of the church's mission to the world is going to be met. What it means above everything else is that the church becomes quite simply what it was meant to be. What is the church? The church is the community of God's people, called by Him out of the world so that they might become the instrument of His purpose in the world. Peter says in his letter, ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a peculiar people, a holy nation, that ye should show forth the praises of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. The church is the company of Jesus. And, says Elton Trueblood in the textbook of this conference, and he says, the company of Jesus is not people streaming to a shrine. And it is not people making up an audience for a speaker. It is laborers engaged in the harvesting task of reaching their perplexed and seeking brethren with something so vital that if it is received, it will change their lives. This is what the church is, gentlemen. The church is the company of the committed. Men and women, old and young, from all walks of life, join together for a common purpose and a common objective, namely, to witness to their faith out there in the world.
The church must witness to the faith out there in the world. The challenge, said Tom Allen, will indeed be met by a company of the committed. And in practice, the company will be a small one.
Now, in theory, the whole membership of the church ought to be concerned with these things. But in practice, this never happens. The call to be the church in the world, to make the grace of God live in our lives, this call is heard only by a few in every congregation. And these are not always the people who are most actively engaged in the church's organizational life. But I'm certain of one thing, and it's this, that in every congregation there exists a small group of people, both men and women, both old and young, who understand the nature of their calling and who are prepared to give time and effort to following it. People who are prepared to submit themselves to the disciplines of the Christian life and to attempt to fulfill their missionary responsibility. Over the years, I've come to believe that the future of the church's mission lies with the emergence of this small group within each congregation. Potentially, it is present in every church and is waiting to be called out and trained in its task. I've seen this happening in my own experience in two widely different parishes. And I believe that it's with the emergence of these small, committed, dynamic, creative groups within the framework of our institutional church that the future lies, not only in industrial areas, but in every kind of situation. I believe that it's in these groups that we begin to break through into the world and meet the challenge of contact, of communication, and of consolidation. This surely has been a principle of spiritual advance and intellectual advance in every age of history. The frontiers are pushed forward not by the great masses, but by the small groups of committed men and women, by the overwhelming minority. And I began to see that it is with this overwhelming minority in every church that the future of the work of the kingdom lies. In calling out these groups, for what purpose? Three things. And over 20 years, I've had the privilege of working with them in these two parishes that I've been in, and I thank God for all the work that's been done by these men and women. Three things these groups exist to do. First, the group exists as a training school in Christian discipleship. As a training school in Christian discipleship. The regular weekly meetings of the group provide an opportunity for the kind of sustained instruction which we need as we prepare ourselves for our mission. It goes without saying that Bible study must be the basis of such instruction, but it must be Bible study related to the pressing concerns of every day, allowing opportunity for sharing in common discussion the problems which confront men and women as they seek to make a Christian witness where they live and play and earn their bread. First, the group is a training school in Christian discipleship. Second, the group exists as an attempt to restore the parochial community. Isn't it true, gentlemen, that the congregation in most areas is seldom more than an aggregate of individuals who scarcely know one another except by sight? A group of individuals who cannot be said to be in any real sense brothers and sisters in Christ, which is what the church was meant to be. The church was meant to be a fellowship sharing a common life. Now, in the group, partly because of its smallness, we begin to discover for the first time what it really means to be members one of another and to participate in that dynamic fellowship of the Spirit which so staggered the pagan world of the first century when it first appeared. And thirdly, the group exists as the agent of mission. This is the practical outcome of the first two. The group exists not only for discussion and for study, not only for fellowship and prayer, but as a trained and disciplined band of witnesses to the world. I want to close today by pointing out the implications of becoming involved with the kind of creative minority of which I've been speaking, and especially of the implications within the framework of our conventional churches. Let's face it. This kind of group, concerned with study, prayer, and witness, is going to produce tension within any congregation by the challenge of its discipline and its commitment. Its very existence demands a revision of our ministerial priorities, because to lead this kind of group is a most demanding task. Its existence also demands a closer examination of the kind of things that take up so much of our time in the conventional program of the modern church's life, the clubs, the fellowships, the gatherings for every conceivable type of activity, badminton, drama, arts and crafts, bowling, country dancing, suppers, you know the kind of thing I mean? Of course you do. You have this kind of institutional life in the church in Canada as we have in Scotland. And we've got to ask ourselves, is this the thing for which the church exists? I believe that the group presents the institutional church with a challenge because this group exists for prayer, study, fellowship, and mission, and it is these things for which God called the church into existence. In his book, The Idea of a Christian Society, T.S. Eliot, the great poet, who is also a devout Anglican, T.S. Eliot distinguishes between what he calls the Christian community, the institutional church, and the community of Christians, which is the church within the church, a group with no definite outline, consisting of both clergy and laity, and owning a common allegiance to Jesus Christ. I think you and I have got to ask ourselves, to which group do we belong? Do we belong to the Christian community, gentlemen? Or do we belong to the community of Christians?